Welcome, everybody. It's a very great pleasure to have Alan Blinder with us to give this year's Lionel Robbins Memorial Lectures, as it happens, the 13th in the series. As you know, Alan is one of the leading macroeconomists in America and in the world, which is why you probably can't find a seat. But some of you may not know that he got off to a very good start by doing the MSc at the London School of Economics. Actually, in those days, there were about twice as many people in the old theatre as now. You may not think you have legroom, but you should have seen the old theatre when Alan was here. From here, he went to the MIT for his PhD. And of course, in those days, the LSE was very monetarist. And the MIT was rather Keynesian. And in a sort of way, I think that Alan could be said to have ended up in the what most of us would think of as the mainstream, somewhere between the extremes. In his work on fiscal policy, for which he's well known, he has always believed in and shown the power of a budget deficit to expand output even when financed by debt. And of course, many of our colleagues were surprised by the Reagan boom, but not Alan. In his work on money, Alan has always stressed the role of credit as the mechanism of transmission, a rather concrete approach to what is going on, which corresponds, of course, to how the agents out there in the economy perceive what's going on. And I think one could perhaps best characterize Alan's economics as an attempt to rationalize in a common sense way what the economic agents think is happening. And it seems to me that this is very much the preferable style for economists than to ignore what the people out there think is happening and invent their own explanations. So Alan has done that kind of economics with great distinction. He's also written a book which many of you may have read, one of the best introductory textbooks written with one of our previous Lionel Robbins lecturers, Bill Baumol. But more recently, he's been on the public stage. He had already, under President Carter, worked in the Congressional Budget Office, but under President Clinton, he's played an important role, first as a member of the Council of Economic Advisers, and then as Vice Chairman of the Federal Reserve Board. When he left the board this January, we thought what a wonderful chance to get his insider view on how central banking actually worked, and it was wonderful when he agreed to come and give these lectures. Of course, the topic of how central banks operate is incredibly important to us in Britain at the moment, because within a couple of years we've got to decide whether to have an independent central bank, as they have in the US, and we've got to decide whether to submerge our bank within a monetary union even bigger than the United States. So what we learn from Alan, I think, will be very relevant to all the concerns which are coming to the fore in this country. Now, after his talk, Alan will take questions, so listen closely. We're very much looking forward to hearing what he has to say. Alan Blinder.
Thank you, Richard. Thank you very much. Can I be seen behind this? I don't usually feel this short, but I do here. Are British people taller than Americans? I wasn't aware that was the case. I'm very grateful for this opportunity to return to my alma mater, a place I've been to infrequently since leaving in the late 60s. Sounds like a long time ago, only because it is. I had a wonderful year here as an LSE student. I learned a bit of economics, had a lot of fun. And the The school was kind enough to give me a degree at the end for all of this, for which I am deeply appreciative. Now, I know that these lectures are titled the Robbins Lectures, after a very great economist, and they're not the Ricardo Lectures. But I ask your indulgence for a moment for a short digression on comparative advantage, because I've long believed that one true test of whether a person is really an economist is how devoutly he or she lives by the principle of comparative advantage. And I don't mean just preaching it, we all do that, but actually practicing it in the way you behave. For example, I have always harbored doubts about some of my economist friends who swear to me that they mow their own lawns because they enjoy it. I always found that claim implausible on its face. But more to the point, if you're really a believer in comparative advantage, you should be constitutionally incapable of enjoying an activity that so grotesquely violates the doctrine. The David Ricardo inside you should make you feel too guilty to do such a thing. Well, being a devotee of comparative advantage, once I agreed to give these lectures, the topic was easily chosen. Our profession boasts greater economic theorists and more skilled econometricians than I. But there are, I think, relatively few people on earth who have been as deeply immersed in monetary policy from both the academic and the central banking sides as I have been. And therein, I presume, lies my comparative advantage and also the topic of these three lectures, the theory and practice of central banking. Now, to keep things manageable, I've pared the title, the topic, a bit beyond what the title may suggest. First, central bankers, I can assure you, are busy with many matters that are related only peripherally, if at all, to monetary policy, such as managing the payments mechanism and supervising banks. I'm going to stick in these lectures to monetary policy proper. Second, I will be dealing much more, and almost exclusively, in fact, with the behavior of central banks rather than with the monetary transmission mechanism. So I won't have anything to say about the monetarist Keynesian controversies of old or anything like that. In these lectures, short-term interest rates will appear as left-hand much more often than right-hand variables. The various issues covered in the three lectures form parts of a mosaic that could, in principle, be taken up in many different orders. But if you're giving a series of lectures on this, you have to draw some artificial boundaries to divide the subject matter into lecture-sized bits. And I've done that in the following way. Tonight, I'll be dealing mainly with a variety of complications that a practical central banker must confront in trying to implement the classical targets instruments approach to stabilization policy. This presentation, tonight's, will beg two important questions that I will address tomorrow. First, what policy instruments should the central bank use? And second, should it attempt discretionary policy at all, rather than just rely on a simple rule? And finally, the last lecture, Thursday night, will be devoted to various positive and especially normative aspects of central bank independence, an issue that Richard was more than alluding to a moment ago, calling our attention to. Now, as these lectures progress, it will become apparent, I believe, that central banking looks rather different in practice than it does in theory. Having seen it from both sides, I deeply believe that both the theory and the practice could benefit from greater contact with, and importantly, greater understanding of, the other side. And so I will periodically, throughout the three lectures, point out what I believe to be opportunities for cross-fertilization, places where central bankers have more to learn from academic research, and places where academic economists could profit from greater awareness of and understanding of the practical world of central banking. In my naivete as an academic economist, I would then say arbitrage should take care of the rest. Having been a practical policymaker, I know that that's not true, but we shall see. Well, let me start with the rudiments of targets and instruments. Monetary policymakers, as you know, have certain targets, such as low inflation, output stability, perhaps external balance, and they have certain instruments to be deployed in meeting those responsibilities, such as bank reserves or interest rates. unless it has only a single goal, something that's been suggested, by the way, but is not true in the United States, the central bank is forced to strike a balance among its competing objectives. That is, to face up to a variety of trade-offs. Now, unless your education in economics is very thin, or, as in the case I suspect of many students here, very recent, those two sentences about targets and instruments immediately bring to mind Tinbergen and Tile, two names, in my experience, many students have never heard of, in fact, but you should. If you haven't heard of it, ask your teacher. So let me begin there at the beginning of the story. In theory, it works like this. Put up a book. There is a known model of the macroeconomy. The word known is important there, and I'm coming back to that, which we can write in structural form as you see it on the board, y as a function of itself, other endogenous variables. So y is the vector of endogenous variables. X is the vector of exogenous, let's leave the word exogenous, policy instruments, which may be of size 1, an interesting special case for monetary policy, a single instrument. And finally, Z is the vector of non-policy exogenous variables. And E is the vector of stochastic disturbances. That vector will fade into insignificance once I assume, following Tinbergen and Tile, that this function F is linear. And the policymaker's objective function, the policymaker's objective function is quadratic. Equation 2 is simply the reduced form where you solve out the y's and write the endogenous variables as functions of the policy instruments and the endogenous variables as functions of the policy instruments and the exogenous variables. Now, in principle, this is a simple problem. The policymaker maximizes, I don't think I need this, the expected value of 3, the objective function, subject to the constraint 2, the reduced form equations for the economy, and thereby derives an optimal policy rule. Which is equation 4 here, defining the settings of the policy instruments as a function of the exogenous variable. It's all very simple. Now, what's wrong with this simple framework? Well, I have a two-sided answer to that question, both nothing and everything. Let me start with the nothing, because I do believe that once you've added a host of complications, several of which I will discuss tonight, this really is the right way for a central banker to think about monetary policy. You have an economy. Except for the policy instruments that you control, you must accept it as it is. That's that first set of equations. You also have multiple objectives, either your own or those assigned to you by the legislature, and you must weigh them somehow, as in equation 3, though perhaps not quadratically, as Tinbergen and Tile presume. To a significant extent, though usually quite informally, and to my mind, not quite sufficiently, that's a point I'll come back to, central bankers do think about policy this way. But as is well known, there are many complications, and this is the everything. What's wrong with this statement? There are many, many complications. And I want to start by listing a few, several of which I will dwell upon at length in the balance of tonight's lecture and tomorrow's. First is that word know. In practice, of course, we do not know the true model of the economy, equations 1 or 2, but must estimate it econometrically. Since economists agree neither on the right model nor on the right econometric techniques, this is a non-trivial problem. It means, among other things, that policy multipliers, which are simply the derivatives of the function g with respect to x, are subject to substantial uncertainties. And I will come back to that in some detail. Second problem is that any reasonable macroeconometric model will have a complex lag structure that is ignored by equation 1. Now, this is not much of a problem in principle, because as all graduate students in economics learn, or at least used to learn, this complication can be accommodated formally simply by appending further equations for lagged variables and making the size of these vectors larger. However, I can tell you that in practice, that creates very serious difficulties that bedevil policymakers. And I'll be returning to the lags in some detail tonight. Third, because of these lags, execution of the Tinberg and Tile framework requires forecasts of the future paths of the exogenous variables. In principle, that's the entire Z vector, which might be quite long. Needless to say, such forecasts are neither easy to generate nor particularly accurate. That's a complication that I won't be saying much about in the lectures. Fourth, again, something I will return to mostly tomorrow, the Tinberg and Tile framework takes as a given that some variables are endogenous, we call them Y, and others are policy instruments, we call them X. In most cases, however, the truth is that the central bank has some latitude, and maybe quite a lot, in choosing its instrument or instruments. One way to think about this is that some of the X's and Y's can trade places at the discretion of the central bank. For example, to make that abstract idea concrete, the short-term interest rate could either be the central bank's policy instrument, with bank reserves an endogenous variable, or the central bank could turn things the other way around and let bank reserves be its instrument, and then the short-term interest rate will be an endogenous variable. And there are other choices as well. Now, some economists take this idea a bit too far and write down models in which central bankers can control, say, something like nominal GDP or the inflation rate or the unemployment rate on a period-by-period basis. If you studied macroeconomics at LSC or almost any place else, I'm sure you have encountered such models. Believe me, take it from me, they cannot do any of those things. No central bank on earth can control precisely on a, say, quarterly basis, not to mention monthly, its nominal GDP, its inflation rate, or its unemployment rate. If they could, monetary policy would be a good deal simpler to do than it in fact is. I come now to the fifth and last of these complications, the objective function, equation 3. And this problem is most usefully framed as a question. Who supplies the objective function? In the classroom, it's simple. The teacher writes it on the board. In a central bank, it's not so simple. And the usual answer is no one provides the objective function. The political authorities, who after all should be deciding such things, rarely, if ever, give such explicit instructions to their central bank. So central bankers must, in a figurative, not a literal sense, create their own social welfare function based on their legal mandate, what the law says they're supposed to do, perhaps their own value judgments, and maybe even their reading of the political will in the country. That last thought brings up the independence of the central bank, a subject I will take up in depth in the closing lecture on Thursday. So if I add all this up, a curmudgeon could summarize the problems with applying the Tinberg and Tile program in the real world as follows. We don't know the model, equation 1, and we don't know the objective function, equation 3, so we can hardly compute the optimal policy rule, equation 4. To some critics of, quote, impractical or, quote, theoretical economics, terms that mean different things in the real world than they do in the university, by the way, including some central bankers, that criticism is a showstopper. There's no way around it. But speaking now as a former central banker rather than a professor, I think that such know-nothingism is not a very useful attitude. In fact, in my view, we must use the Tinberg and Tile approach, handling as many of the complications as we can, even if we do so in a rather informal way. And an analogy will explain why. Consider your role as the owner of an automobile. You have various objectives toward which the use of your car contributes, such as getting to work, going shopping, going on pleasure trips. Unless you're a very unusual person, you don't literally know the utility function that weights these objectives, but you presumably wish to maximize it anyway. At least that's what we economists presume. The care and feeding of your car entails considerable expense, and if you're like me, there is great uncertainty about the model that maps inputs like gasoline and oil changes and tires into outputs like safe and uneventful trips. Furthermore, there are substantial stochastic lags between the maintenance expenditures, like changing the oil, and their payoff, like greater engine longevity. So what do you do faced with such a devilishly complicated program? Well, one alternative is called the putting out fires strategy. That's meant figuratively, though in the auto case it sometimes means that literally. And with this strategy, you do nothing for your car until it breaks down. Then you fix whatever is broken and continue driving until something else breaks down. I submit that few of us follow this strategy because we know it will produce poor results. Instead, we all follow something that approximates, philosophically if not mathematically, this Tinbergen and Tile framework. And that's what central banks do as well. Or at least they should. For they will surely fail in their stabilization policy mission if they adopt the putting out fires strategy and simply wait for something to go wrong and then try to set it right. So let me then try to review briefly how the Tinbergen Tile framework is used in practice rather than in classroom theory, where you simply have this quadratic function and you maximize it subject to a set of linear constraints. Well, to begin with, you need a macroeconomic model. Now, this model need not be a system of several hundred stochastic difference equations, although frankly, that's not such a bad place to start. In point of fact, no central bank that I know of, and certainly not the Federal Reserve, is literally wed to any single econometric model of its economy. So it doesn't really write down that equation one and say that is the world. Some central banks, many, have such models, but some don't, at least don't have any models that they use in any serious way. But even if they don't have such a model, or don't use it, some kind of a model of the macroeconomy, however informal it may be, is necessary to do policy. Because just think about it. If you have no model of the economy, no, quote, theory, unquote, how could you even begin to estimate the effects of changing the policy instruments? How could you even start asking yourself the counterfactual question, what will happen to things I care about if I twiddle the dials? Just thinking about that question systematically and at all quantitatively means that you are employing, in some sense, a model of the economy. Now, some central bankers scoff at large-scale macroeconometric models, as, by the way, do some academic economists, maybe many academic economists these days. And ironically, or I don't know if it's ironically or not, the reasons for this ridicule from two very different types of people are not all that dissimilar, have many points in common. Many critics, for example, point to the likelihood of structural change in any economy over a period of several decades, which cast doubt on the stationarity assumptions that underlie standard econometric procedures, and by doing so, cast doubt on the bedrock notion of statistical inference that the past can be used as a guide to the future. And if we dispense with that, we really are at sea without a rudder. Other critics express skepticism that something as complicated as an entire economy can be captured in any set of equations, even if there are hundreds of them and scores of people work on the model. Still other critics emphasize a host of technical problems in time series econometrics that cast doubt on any set of estimated coefficients. Finally, some central bankers simply don't understand these ungainly creatures at all and doubt that they should be expected to. It's not part of the job description. Leaving that last aspect of the criticism aside, there really is truth in each of those criticisms. Every model, no matter how complicated, is an oversimplification. We all know that economies do change over time. Econometric equations often fail subsample stability tests, suggesting structural changes over time. Econometric problems like simultaneity, common trends, and omitted variables are ubiquitous in non-experimental data. And that's all we ever have in macroeconomics anyway, and mostly in microeconomics. Yet what are we to do about that formidable list of difficulties? Be skeptical? Of course, absolutely. Use several methods and several models instead of relying on just one? Certainly. But abandon all econometric modeling? I think not. The criticisms of macroeconometrics are not wrong, they're mostly right. But their importance is often exaggerated, in my view, and even more fundamentally, their implications are misunderstood. These criticisms, valid as they are, should be taken as warnings, as calls for humility, caution, and flexibility of mind, not as excuses to retreat into nihilism. It is foolish, and indeed in central banking, I think, dangerous, to make the best the enemy of the moderately useful, never mind the good. We use a weaker criterion than that. Indeed, I would take this point further. I don't see that central bankers even have the luxury of ignoring econometric estimates. Monetary policy requires more than just qualitative information that you can get from economic theory. For example, the qualitative statement that if short-term interest rates rise, real GDP growth will subsequently decline. And I might say under my breath, by the way, who says the theory always gets the signs right anyway? But even if the theory does, always gets the sign right, always get the signs right, excuse me, you need more. To do monetary policy, you must have quantitative information about magnitudes and lags, even if that information is imperfect. I often used to, and indeed I still do, put the choice this way. You can get your information about the economy from admittedly fallible statistical relationships, or you can ask your uncle. Now, I, for one, have never hesitated much over that choice, and I don't think it's a reflection on the quality of uncles that I have. But I do fear and do believe that there is altogether too much uncle asking in government circles in general and in central bank circles in particular. And as I said, to me, that is evidence of making the wrong choice. Well, having said that, let me turn now to the first of three important amendments to the Tinbergen and Tile framework that'll take most of account for most of this evening's lecture. Beginning with the obvious fact that I've alluded to twice already, I think, that no one knows the true model of the economy. Well, it would hardly have been news to Tinbergen and Tile, even though both of them lived in ancient history, that most, or wrote in ancient history, I should say, that most models and forecasts of exogenous variables are subject to considerable uncertainty. And subsequent technical developments by a variety of economists have indeed provided us ways of either handling or finessing these gaps in our knowledge. That's not quite the same thing. So let me consider very briefly three different types of uncertainty. First, uncertainty about forecasts. In the linear-quadratic case, the model is linear and the objective function is quadratic, uncertainty about the values of future exogenous variables is no problem at all in principle. You need only replace unknown future variables with their expected values, the so-called certainty equivalence principle. And I think we still teach this in graduate school, don't we? Do we? We do, okay. And your teacher probably covers this in about 15 seconds. It's really simple. But, in principle, this is one case in which the gap between theory and practice is enormous. Because in the real world, the task of generating unbiased forecasts of dozens, let alone hundreds, of exogenous variables, things you would need to put expected values in as placeholders for the random variables in those equations, that task is a titanic practical problem. And it is, I believe, a major reason why large-scale econometric models are not terribly useful as forecasting tools. You can try to do it mechanically. Even the mechanics are difficult. And the results you get out at the other end are not likely to be very good because this huge vector of exogenous variables well into the future is basically not forecastable. Now, skeptics often object to certainty equivalence on the grounds that, first of all, the economy is not linear, and secondly, there is no particular reason to think that the objective function is quadratic. Both of these objections are undoubtedly true, and if taken literally, invalidate the certainty equivalence principle. But I think the importance of that point is often exaggerated by those who would denigrate the usefulness and thereby escape the discipline of formal econometric models. Policymakers in the real world will almost always, both words are important, the almost and the always, almost always be contemplating changes in their policy instruments that can be expected to lead to small changes in macroeconomic variables. For changes like that, any model of an economy is approximately linear, and any convex objective function is approximately quadratic. So this problem of principle is, in my view, of great practical importance only on those rare occasions when policymakers are contemplating very large changes in policy. That does happen sometime, but it is not part of the workaday business of monetary policy. Second type of uncertainty that is important is uncertainty about the parameters, and therefore about policy multipliers. And that's much more difficult to handle, even at the conceptual level. The certainty equivalence principle certainly does not apply here. While there are some fairly sophisticated techniques for dealing with parameter uncertainty in optimal control models with learning, those methods have not attracted the attention of either macroeconomists or policymakers. And I think there is good reason for the inattention to this body of academic literature. The reason is simple, that you don't conduct experiments on a real economy in order to sharpen your econometric estimates. That's what that class of econometric analysis and theory is about, doing experiments to learn something about the parameters. Believe me, you don't do that if you're sitting on a central bank board. There is, however, one often forgotten principle that I suspect practical central bankers can, and in a rough way do, rely upon. Many years ago, in fact, when I was a student at the LSE, this is a really long time ago, William Brainerd of Yale, this is in 1967, demonstrated that under certain conditions, and it is a special case, you can overturn this conclusion, but under certain conditions, uncertainty about policy multipliers should make policymakers conservative in the following specific sense: that they should compute the direction and magnitude of their optimal policy move in the way prescribed by Tinbergen and Tile, and then do less. In the same direction, but less. So that's the concrete example of conservative. I mean, it has nothing to do with Labour and Tories. but it's conservative more or less in the dictionary sense of the term. Now, here I like to show you a trivial adaptation of Brainerd's simple example. Equation 2 prime is just a linearization of equation 2 that was on the board a moment ago. It's the reduced form of the economy, here written as a system of linear equations. Now, let's suppose that in both G, the vector of coefficient, the matrix of coefficients, and Z, the exogenous variables, are independent random variables which have means small g in the case of capital G and Z bar in the case of the vector Z. The policymaker wishes to maximize the square deviation of its target y from where it would like y to be. Call that y star. I meant to put that equation that I just said verbally on the slide, but I forgot to do it. Finally, interpret the sum z plus e, what you have here before you get to the gx part. Interpret that sum, z plus e, as the value that the variable y would attain in the absence of any further policy move, so that if x is equal to 0. So I want to find x to be the contemplated change in policy. So if I don't change policy, I set x equal to 0, and I get out the random variable z plus e. Now, if we start with the Tinbergen and Tile framework, if g is non-random, the optimal policy adjustment is certainty equivalent. You just compute the amount of x you need when multiplied by g to close the gap between y star, where you want this target to be. So think of that, say, as inflation, and y star is zero inflation, or something like that, and z bar. You fully close the gap. You fully close the expected gap. That's a random variable. But if the matrix capital G is random with mean lowercase g, and a standard deviation, sigma, the loss function is then minimized by setting x at the value shown there, which I will not try to read. But if you look at it, you see the denominator is larger than the expected value of g. And therefore, the setting of x is in the same direction, up or down, but smaller in absolute value. That's the Brainerd conservatism principle in a very specific and simple example. Now, my intuition tells me that this finding of Brainerd's is more general, or at least more wise, in the real world than the mathematics will support. Mathematically speaking, this is a very special case, and it's easy to overturn the conclusion. And I can tell you, I certainly hope that that's the case, for it was never far from my mind when I occupied the vice chairman's office at the Federal Reserve. In my view, as both a citizen and a policymaker, a little bit of stodginess at the central bank, conservatism in exactly this meaning, is entirely appropriate. Now, uncertainty about parameters, while difficult to handle, is at least a relatively well-defined problem. Selecting the right model from a variety of non-nested alternatives is another matter entirely. While there is some formal literature on this problem, I think it's safe to say that central bankers neither know nor care much about that literature. And I leave it to each of you as an open question whether they're missing much by ignoring it. My approach to the problem while on the Federal Reserve was relatively simple. Use a wide variety of models and don't ever trust any one of them too much. So, for example, when the Federal Reserve staff explored policy alternatives, I always insisted on seeing results from our own econometric model, from several alternative econometric models, those are usually commercial models, and from a variety of vector autoregression models that I developed for exactly that purpose. And my usual procedure was to simulate any one policy on as many of these models as was possible, throw away the outliers, and average the rest. And that was my econometric technique for getting a point estimate of a dynamic multiplier path. I think that can be viewed as a rough, or make that very rough, approximation to optimal information processing, which would have to weight these things by variances and covariances. But it seemed to me good enough for government work. Let me now turn to the other second problem that I mentioned I would take up in some detail, not uncertainty, but lags. It's a commonplace, of course, by now that monetary policy operates on the economy with, quote, long and variable lags. As I mentioned before, the formalism of the Tinbergen and Tile framework can readily accommodate distributed lags. The costs are two. First, the dimensionality of the problem increases. Now, in the old days, when I was a student at the LSE, that used to be a big deal. But with modern computing power, dimensionality is really not much of a problem at all. Second, the optimization problem changes from one of calculus to one of the calculus of variations, or as I prefer to think of it, dynamic programming. This latter point is significant in practice and I think inadequately appreciated by practitioners. So I'd like to dwell on that just a bit. A dynamic programming problem is typically solved backward. That is, if capital T is the final period of the problem and X is the decision variable, the policy instrument, you begin by solving a one-period problem for, this comes out verbally, TXT, but you see it's lower prescript, lowercase t, postscript, uppercase T. The notation here is that the postscript is the date to which the variable applies. So this is the setting of the policy variable X at time capital T, the last period. And the prescript is the date at which you make the decision and formulate the expectations. Once you have done that and have a solution which most likely depends, among other things, on the value of the control instrument in the previous period, you then solve a two-period problem for both of them together. And once you've done that, you solve a three-period problem for all three, and you work inductively back to the present, eventually deriving a whole solution path that looks like this. All of these things have the decision date the same, time t, but they apply to different periods in the future, one period, zero period, one period, two period, and so on into the future. Now, don't get me wrong. I do not believe it is important for central bankers to acquire any deep understanding of Bellman's principle, still less of the computational techniques needed to implement it. What really matters for sound decision making, I think, is the way dynamic programming teaches us to think about intertemporal optimization problems and the discipline it imposes on that thought process. It is absolutely essential, in my view, for central bankers to realize that in a dynamic economy with long lags in monetary policy, today's monetary policy decision must be thought of as the first step along a path. And the reason for that is painfully simple. Unless you have thought through your expected future actions, it is impossible to make today's decision rationally. For example, when a central bank begins a cycle of either tightening or easing, it should, and in my view must, have some idea about where it's going to end up. And it should have that idea in mind before it takes the first step. Now, of course, by the time the next period rolls around, T plus one, the policymakers will have new information, and they may wish to change their minds about their earlier tentative decision, TXT plus one. This is a hypothetical decision. You don't actually act on it. And that's fine. And in fact, given the information then available, dynamic programming teaches us that the policymaker will then want to plan an entirely new path, with the dating of the information date or the decision date all updated to T plus one. And unless no new information has come into the system between T and T plus one, in general, all those numbers are different. The entire path is different. But that realization in no way obviates the need to think ahead in order to make today's decision, which is the important lesson that we take from dynamic programming. It is, in my view, an intensely practical lesson and one that I think is inadequately understood in the practical world of central banking. Too often, decisions on monetary policy, and indeed I might say on other policies as well, are taken one step at a time without any clear notion of what the next several steps are likely to be. In central banking circles, for example, it is often claimed that such one step at a time decision making is wise because it maintains, quote, flexibility and guards against, quote, getting locked in to decisions that the central bank will later regret. I heard sentiments like that expressed in many meetings of the Federal Open Market Committee and at many international meetings of central bankers. It is viewed as the height of wisdom. But this attitude reflects a fundamental misunderstanding of the way dynamic programming teaches us to think. And again, it's not the computational techniques, it's the thought process. It is absolutely correct that flexibility should and must be maintained, and that locking yourself in is to be avoided. But both of those notions are inherent in dynamic programming. They're the essence of dynamic programming. If there are any surprises at all, the decisions that you actually wind up carrying out in the future will differ from the ones that you originally planned. That's flexibility. But ignoring your own likely future actions is not flexibility, it's myopia, and likely to lead to error. I'd like to make that abstract discussion more concrete by talking briefly about a particular type of error which central bankers, both in the US and elsewhere, have frequently been accused of making. Specifically, I don't think I'll need this projector any longer. Specifically, it is alleged that central banks frequently overstay their policy stance, whether it's tightening or loosening, thereby causing overshoots in both directions, staying tight for too long, staying loose for too long. I think that criticism may be correct, although I think the systematic evidence to establish that it is correct is not yet at hand. And I furthermore believe that the error, if it exists, may be due to following a strategy that I call looking out the window, which, as you'll see, is the opposite of dynamic programming. What's the looking out the window strategy? Well, a central bank following the looking out the window strategy proceeds as follows. For just to make the discussion concrete, assume it's in the process of tightening, but you could just change the words and it'd be a process of loosening. At each decision juncture, the central bank takes the economy's temperature, and if it finds that it's still too hot, tightens monetary conditions another notch. Given the long lags in monetary policy, I think you can easily see how a strategy like that can keep a central bank tightening for too long, and in the other direction, loosening for too long. Now compare looking out the window to proper dynamic optimization. Under dynamic programming, at each stage, the bank would project an entire future path of its monetary policy actions with associated paths of key economic variables like, say, unemployment and inflation, maybe the exchange rate. It would, of course, act only on today's decision and forget about the rest. Then, if things evolved as expected as the future unfolded, it would keep following its projected path, which would be likely, given the lags in monetary policy, to tell it to stop tightening while the economy was still hot. because the incipient tightening is already in the system. Now, of course, economies rarely evolve exactly as expected. Surprises are the norm, not the exception. And they would induce the central bank to alter its expected path in obvious ways. If the economy steamed ahead faster than was expected, the bank would tighten more. If the economy slowed down sooner than was expected, the bank would tighten less, or maybe even reverse its stance. Now, an important question is, do central banks actually behave that way? Well, I think the answer is yes and no. Like a skilled billiards player who doesn't understand the laws of physics, a skilled practitioner of monetary policy may wind up following a dynamic programming type strategy intuitively and informally. In the last few years, for example, the notion that it is wise to pursue a strategy of what's come to be called preemptive strikes against inflation seems to have caught on among central bankers. The main impetus for this change in fashion was, I believe, the leadership and perceived success of the Federal Reserve in first tightening monetary policy, quote, preemptively in early 1994, and then achieving the fabled soft landing. And by now, a variety of other central banks are talking the same talk. But the very fact that this style of decision-making was perceived to be a great advance in central banking suggests that the dynamic programming way of thinking has not yet permeated thought in central bank circles. A preemptive strategy implies a certain amount of confidence, both in your forecast and in your model of how monetary policy affects the economy, both of which are hazardous, to be sure. But preemption doesn't require too much confidence, I don't believe. Because remember the flexibility principle of dynamic programming and the Brainard conservatism principle. And here I want to put them together. If you combine those two ideas, they lead to the following sort of strategy for a central bank. Step one, estimate how much you need to tighten or loosen monetary policy in order to get it right. Then do less. That's the Brainard conservatism. Step two, watch how things evolve. Step three comes in one of two versions. If things evolve more or less the way you expected them to evolve, increase your tightening or loosening, whichever you were doing, toward where you thought it should ultimately be in the first place. But the second variant is if the economy seems to be evolving differently from what you expected, adjust your policy accordingly. Two final points about preemptive monetary policy are worth making. First, a successful stabilization policy based on preemptive strikes may appear to be misguided and may therefore leave the central bank open to severe criticism. The reason is simple. If the monetary authority tightens so early that inflation never rises, the preemptive strike against inflation is, of course, a resounding success. But critics of the central bank will wonder, and many of them will wonder out loud, why the bank decided to tighten when the inflationary dragon was nowhere to be seen. Similarly, a successful preemptive strike against economic slack will prevent unemployment from rising and leave critics, usually on the opposite end of the ideological spectrum, complaining that the authorities were hallucinating about rising unemployment. It never happened. Precisely these criticisms of the Federal Reserve's tightening in 94 and early 95 and subsequent easing from mid-95 into early 96 were heard and continue to be heard in the United States. So this is not a hypothetical danger of a central bank. It actually happens. Second, the logic behind the preemptive strike strategy is symmetrical. Precisely the same reasoning that tells a central bank to get a head start against inflation says it should also strike preemptively against rising unemployment. And that is why Fed Chairman Alan Greenspan told Congress in February 1995 just after the Fed had completed a year-long tightening cycle that raised short-term interest rates in the U.S. by 300 basis points. He told Congress that, quote, "There may come a time when we hold our policy stance unchanged or even ease, despite adverse price data, should we see signs that underlying forces are acting ultimately to reduce inflationary pressures," end of quote. In fact, that statement itself, which Greenspan delivered in mid-February of 95, amounted to a monetary easing, since it fueled the bond market rally way before the Fed started cutting interest rates, which happened almost five months later. Notably, both Greenspan's February statement and the Fed's interest rate cut in July of 1995 came while the unemployment rate was below contemporary estimates of the natural rate. Below, not above. Now, when might the preemptive strike strategy apply more to inflation fighting than to unemployment fighting? First, if the short-run Phillips curve is distinctly nonlinear in the way that Phillips and Lipsey originally drew the Phillips curves, so that low unemployment raises inflation more than high unemployment lowers it. But with due apologies to those notable and noble, I might say, curve-fitting exercises done right here at the LSE in the 1950s, the U.S. evidence is decidedly against this hypothesis. A linear Phillips curve fits the data extremely well, and indeed, tests for nonlinearity suggest, if anything, a Phillips curve that's concave to the origin rather than the convex one that you find in Phillips' writing. Second, lags in monetary policy could be longer for inflation than for unemployment, and that would call for earlier preemption in the former case than in the latter case. And that does indeed appear to be true in the U.S. and virtually all countries. Third, the central bank's loss function could attach much more weight to inflation than to unemployment, as some observers of central banking have suggested. And that's something I will be returning to in the next couple of lectures. Well, I come near the end of the story, but so far have offered only one explanation for the alleged tendency of central banks to overstay their stance, remaining tight for too long, thereby causing a recession, and remaining loose for too long, thereby allowing inflation to take root. The one explanation for that I've given so far is a failure, what I characterize as a failure to internalize the dynamic programming way of thinking. But there is also a prominent institutional feature of some central banks, including the Federal Reserve, which may contribute to this problem. Specifically, in many countries, monetary policy is made not by a single individual optimizing the way Tinbergen and Tile envisioned it, but by that most dreadful of all things, a committee. While serving on the Federal Open Market Committee, I was vividly reminded of a few things that all of us probably know about committees. That they laboriously aggregate individual preferences, that they need to be led or they never get anywhere, that they tend to adopt compromise positions on difficult questions, and perhaps because of all of those, that they tend to be quite inertial. I believe that if Newton had served on more faculty committees at Cambridge, fortunately for Cambridge, I don't think he served on many, his first law of motion might have read, "A decision-making body at rest or in motion tends to stay at rest or in motion in the same direction unless acted upon by an outside force." Inertial behavior has its virtues, as I will remark shortly, but it also has some vices. In particular, decision-making by committee may contribute to the systematic policy errors that I've mentioned already, by inducing the central bank to maintain its policy stance, whichever direction, for too long a time. While the FOMC has not been immune to this ailment over the years, there is at least one tradition at the Federal Reserve that tends to minimize it, and that is the tradition of a powerful chairman. If you read the Federal Reserve Act, it says that each of the 12 voting members of the FOMC has one vote. That's what the law says. But no one has ever doubted that Alan Greenspan, or Paul Volcker, or Arthur Burns were more equal than the others. The chairman of the Federal Reserve Board is virtually never on the losing side of a monetary policy vote. So to a significant extent, FOMC decisions are his decisions as tempered by the opinions of the other members of the committee. Nonetheless, a chairman that needs to build consensus in his committee may have to move more slowly than if he were acting alone. So some inertia remains. Now for the positive side. I said there are some virtues of inertia. I come, as most of you know, from the land of checks and balances. American political traditions harbor great fear of unbridled, centralized government power. It's really an anti-government form of government, the little government that couldn't, because it was too tied up in procedural knots. Yet the Federal Open Market Committee, a piece of the US government, has virtually total freedom to do as it pleases with monetary policy without asking permission from any other branch of government and with little, if any, fear of being countermanded. So long as the Fed's decisions are done by the book and remain within its legal authority, the Federal Open Market Committee is neither checked nor balanced, or at least not externally checked or balanced. But the group nature of FOMC decision-making creates, I believe, what amounts to an internal system of checks and balances. No chairman can deviate too far from the view that prevails in his committee. Decision-making by committee, especially when there is a strong tradition of consensus, as there is at the Fed, makes it very difficult for idiosyncratic views to prevail. So monetary policy decisions tend to regress toward the mean and to be inertial, and hence they are biased in precisely the same way expectations are biased relative to rational expectations. But errors like that, while systematic, that's why they're not rational expectations, will generally be small and, more important, will tend to shrink over time. And in return for that, the system builds in natural safeguards against truly horrendous mistakes. Well, I leave it to some clever theorist at the LSE or somewhere else to prove that the FOMC is an example of optimal institutional design. It would be quite a challenge, I can tell you. More generally, my experience as a member of the FOMC left me with a strong feeling that the theoretical fiction that monetary policy is made by a single individual, maximizing a well-defined preference function, misses something important. In my view, monetary theorists should start paying some attention to the nature of decision-making by committee, which is rarely, if ever, mentioned in the academic literature on monetary policy. Overall, however, the message of tonight's lecture is rather cheerful, I think, for academicians. Working in their cloistered universities, Tinbergen, Tile, Brainerd, and others taught valuable abstract lessons, which turned out to be of direct practical use in central banking. So did other scholars who developed their ideas further, pointed out additional complexities, and brought more powerful technical tools to bear, such as macroeconometric models and dynamic programming. Their ideas do not provide pat answers for central bankers, and their techniques cannot be applied mechanically. The real world is much too complicated for that. So there will always be both art and science in central banking. Nonetheless, the science is still useful. At least I found it so while I was on the Federal Reserve Board. In fact, I think central bankers could learn a good deal more from academics than they have. For example, I emphasize tonight that the dynamic programming way of thinking is not yet sufficiently ingrained into the habits of monetary policymakers who too often just look out the window and base their policy judgments on present circumstances. I believe that's a fundamental mistake and is one reason why central banks often overstay their policy stance. There also seems to be, in my judgment, too much reliance on uncle asking relative to econometric evidence among practical central bankers. Skepticism about econometric estimates is one thing and is highly appropriate, but healthy skepticism should not be allowed to devolve into econometric nihilism, which is too often nothing but an excuse for wishful thinking and an escape from the discipline of the data. But please don't think that I think all wisdom resides in universities, from where it flows, though somewhat impeded, to central banks. Tomorrow's lecture should dispel that notion entirely. After dealing briefly with one more issue where academic thinking was both correct and triumphant, that's the choice of monetary instrument, I will then turn in detail to the rules versus discretion debate, where I will argue that much of the recent academic research has been barking up the wrong trees. On that issue, I believe the academics have much to learn from the central bankers. Thank you.
You've given us a model lecture, and I can see that you have there the first part of a really classic book, because I think that many of the thoughts which we've heard tonight are new to many and perhaps most of us. You presented them in a wonderful way, clear, exciting, and of course deeply relevant. Thank you very, very much. Now we'll go on to some questions. Who would like to start? Don't be shy.
First is always the hardest.
Christopher.
Can you hear me all right?
I can.
This question falls into two parts. First of all, would the first part of your lecture apply equally well to any other arm of government setting policy variables? I mean, there's nothing that seems to be specific to central banking about most of what you've said so far. Now, the other problem is with other arms of government setting their policy variables, notably Congress setting fiscal policy, this, from the central bank's point of view, is part of the exogenous variables that they have to try to predict in their model. And is this not a major difficulty? I mean, either for the people setting fiscal policy or for the people setting monetary policy. They cannot predict the total sum of
Mm-hmm. Okay, let me, could you hear the question?
No, repeat it.
It depends how good your ear sight is. I'll paraphrase the question. The question was, does the first part of the lecture apply to other arms of government, different functions, and then the example of fiscal policy was brought up specifically as one of the variables, so to speak, that's exogenous to monetary policy, that the monetary policymakers take as a given. I think the answer to that is yes, as long as they share the following two, I think, unless I leave something. It's always dangerous to start a sentence by saying the following two, because by the time you get to the end of the sentence, you've got three. I think I have two in mind now, the following two attributes. The first of which, of course, they have, which is uncertainty. There's no such thing as certainty in the real world of policymaking. No interesting policy has certain results. So all of the policies share that aspect. But secondly, most important, that they be very much oriented, that their main effects come in the future rather than in the present. There are some, and that's quite typical, but not universal. Some types of policies have most of their effects quite soon. And others, for others, you have to wait a long time to see their impact. Monetary policy is a quintessential example of the sort where you have to wait a long time to see the impact, but by no means alone in that regard. So I think if you take any other sort of government policy, and by the way, you don't have to restrict yourself to economic policy, that has these two attributes, it will share many of the same problems, and much of the same sort of analysis will apply. Now, in the specific application to fiscal policy, and I would contrast this to monetary policy, I'll be very brief on what I'm about to say because I'm going to dwell on this at length in Thursday's lecture. In monetary policy is assigned, in the United States at least, and many other countries, to non-political, some are more non-political than others, but basically non-political technocrats with long terms of office. Fiscal policy is basically assigned to politicians with short terms of office, sometimes very short terms of office. As I think most of you know, we elect the House of Representatives every 2 years in America. The whole House of Representatives, 435 people. In principle, they could all go out in 2 years. That doesn't quite happen, although to the Democrats, it seemed like it almost happened in 1994. Because of that, you have very different sorts of decision makers with their hands on the fiscal throttles versus on the monetary throttles. And so I think that makes for a very different style in practice of decision making. I'm going to talk about that in the context of central bank independence on Thursday. But in principle, it's quite similar.
Next.
No, that's a very good practical question, and you used exact. Oh, sorry, I should. Let me rephrase the question. Given that I've said that central bankers do, or I really should correct you slightly, say should use a dynamic programming framework for solving out for policy settings. It seems that an important practical question is the setting of capital T, the horizon. How long, over what horizon are you optimizing? And you're exactly right. It's a practical question. When you do this on the blackboard, it doesn't much matter, and you can set T is set equal to infinity, and you know it's just not an issue. In the practical world, it's a huge practical issue. In the real world, it's a huge practical issue. And I've thought about this a good deal. I think a reasonable, rough and ready answer to the question is, I'll be spuriously accurate in my answer. I don't mean this literally. 3 years. Now, why do I say 3 years? Remembering, I don't literally mean 3 years. Well, let's change it. 3 to 5 years. That's what I mean. 3 to 5 years. I pick that because that's a period based on the evidence that I, as I see it, for the United States, and I suspect for most countries, virtually beyond the monetary policy horizon. In the sense that today's monetary policy decisions will have very little effect, will practically have no effect on employment 3 to 5 years from today, but will have an intense effect on employment 1 to 1.5 years from today, and on inflation. For inflation, you need the longer end of the legs. It will leave, of course, a permanent imprint on the price level. So part of my answer is an implicit adoption of the attitude that the inflation rate is much more important than the price level. And you could argue over that. But when I thought about this in the practical way as opposed to in the academic way, that's what I was thinking of, something like that. You need to plan out where do you think we're going for the next 3 years or so. Work back. What does that mean for today? That's not going to give you a perfect solution because the effects are not literally zero beyond the three-year horizon. But I think it would probably take you a long way in the right direction.
Next one.
Right. The question was that I emphasized briefly in this discussion of central banking committee two seemingly conflicting points. One is that academics ought to pay more attention to the fact that monetary policy decisions in many, though not all, countries are made by committees. And on the other hand, I emphasize the fact that the chairman of the Fed generally has pretty good control and leadership over the Federal Open Market Committee. Well, the answer is, I mentioned in the U.S. case, I mean you to think someplace in the middle. And the way I see it is that the Federal Open Market Committee at any given meeting, and there are generally eight of them in a year, makes the decision that the chairman wants on that day. But in some instances, the chairman's view of what he wants the committee to do that day may be heavily conditioned on what he perceives either before the meeting or during the meeting to be the attitudes of the rest of the committee. So he's exerting leadership, but in the rare event that leadership fails, he can always jump to the head of the queue and say, you know, that was my idea all along. Now, that's not the norm by any means. The norm is that the chairman is the leader of the group and is more or less getting the group to go along with his view. But what it means is that it's very difficult for the chairman to be a statistical outlier on the committee. If he is, in fact, in what he really believes, he has to temper that view, to move it a little bit, regress it towards the mean a bit, in order to keep the consensus, which on the Federal Reserve is always considered very important. If he only wanted to win a 7-5 vote, I don't think it would be important. The chairman of the Fed has enough control that the odds that he's going to lose a vote, literally, are just very, very tiny. There's a very rare historical circumstance. But if he wants a 12-0 vote, or at worst an 11-1 vote, and that's what Fed chairmen want, he may have to move his position a little in the direction of the rest of the committee if he's not in the middle of it.
But I wasn't quite clear from your analysis whether you thought the decision would be better if there wasn't the committee.
Well, I was four square straddling that one. there are virtues and vices. The vice is that it makes things more inertial. And so the central bank continues along a path probably longer than it should. The virtues, and I tend to think, if you force me off the straddle, I think, that the virtue is a little bit more important. The virtue is it is a check against truly horrendous monetary policy errors. If you imagine a chairman of the Federal Reserve that gets some lunatic idea in his head, and with the power that he has, if he didn't have his committee, he would just do it. Now, blissfully, we have not had such lunatics leading the Federal Reserve, but if you think of institutional design, you want to make it, quote, foolproof. That's a beautiful English word. I mean, it means exactly what it says, foolproof. And the committee design is an insurance policy against a wild central banker that might do something crazy. And I think probably, as you force me off the straddle, preventing that from happening once in a half century is probably worth the little inertia cost that you pay repeatedly with every monetary policy cycle of tightening or easing.
Next one.
Speak just a little louder, please.
Sorry, this is a theoretical question, and I'm not very well versed in lifecycle programming. But essentially, what you're describing is a path based on a model that you have, and you want to see what that path is, and come back and see like if you should follow the path.
Right.
Like the first thing that you said when you gave the picture was that your model in the first place is going to be very precise because you have that vector. What I'm asking is it really any different result wise if I use the other method, which you're talking about, which is, you know, I take the temperature, but I put in some sort of lag, which I can estimate. And I mean, the idea of lag, is very new. And introduce the lag to my policy variable, and simply follow that kind of rule.
I think it may. Let me try to paraphrase the question. The question basically was whether I didn't draw much too sharp, this is a strong paraphrasing of your question, much too sharp a dichotomy between the, quote, proper dynamic programming approach and what I called looking out the window. As long as the people that look out the window are mindful of the fact that there are lags in the system and things may change. The answer is the more you bring in the lags correctly, the more these two approaches meld one to another. But I think there is a difference, and a very practical difference. Whether it's a large difference or not is entirely circumstantial. It could be a trivial difference or it could be a large difference. And the difference is this. If you think through using a model, admittedly an imperfect model, an entire path and associated with that an expected evolution of the macroeconomic variables, you can distinguish between changes and surprises. So when the economy changes along a path that comes close to what you thought it should be doing, that's some verification to you of some combination of your model is okay, and you did the right thing. On the other hand, when you see it's going off of what you thought, that rings the bell that either you did the wrong thing or there's something wrong with the model. The looking at the window strategy is far too myopic and is constantly just, is overweighting current conditions relative to likely future conditions. Now, the essential truth in your remark is as you move down that overweighting, you start approaching dynamic programming. But then you're there. Then you really are doing dynamic programming, tacitly, if not explicitly.
Well, I think that we should let Alan off the hook. He is, as you know, on a dynamic path with two more stops. Tomorrow evening at 5:30 and Thursday evening at 5:30. He's told us what he's going to be telling us about, but he hasn't given us the answers. We're really looking forward to hearing them. I hope to see everybody here tomorrow to continue the saga. We've had a wonderful evening. Let us all thank Alan again.